This is the Farming for a Better Climate podcast. Hello and welcome to this Farming for a Better Climate podcast. My name is Seamus Murphy and today I'm joined by Robert Ramsey and Lorna Galloway. Hello to you both.
Hi Seamus.
Hi Seamus.
How are you doing? What's the any kind of news in Ayrshire or Stranraer?
The drought is over anyway, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, harvest is stalled. Lots of people champing at the bit to get going, and grass growth is still quite slow despite, you know, the volume of rain we had. I would say this year we've never really seen a big peak in grass growth, so it's been quite a challenging season.
I think we're maybe beginning to see it. I think it's really getting in gear again here. You know, I think, and in fairness, we've been complaining about the weather. Like, we've been complaining, you know, it was too dry and too hot, and then it got too wet quite quick. But ground's in great order. And actually, up to probably this week, we were still in a moisture deficit. Like, we were still needing all the moisture that was coming. So I see, particularly at home, I have a field of kale in, and it really is growing like thunder now. And it's always nice to see it at that stage. It's hopefully beyond the flea beetle story, and once it gets going, it takes forever to get started, and once it gets going, it's amazing to see. And I think we're probably in for, if it only comes good in the next wee while, you know, this could be a remarkably good year. But only time will tell. It's a crystal ball. We could be talking in 2 weeks' time about how it's a disaster.
I suppose that mention of kind of grass growth there, and there's a lot of things I suppose you have to get right to take advantage of those kind of bumper years, and it probably leads us in nicely to what we're here to talk about today, which is some of the kind of trials that you guys have been leading on at Woodhead Farm, just outside Galston in Ayrshire, under the Farming for a Better Climate program. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what yous are doing at Woodhead?
Yeah, so Woodhead's been quite an exciting place for me for a good number of years. So Woodhead, John Kerr was one of the climate change focus farms. I think it was 2015. We started there. So he was a focus farmer for 3 years. And we did a lot of good stuff, changed quite a lot of his system or helped him change a lot of his system along the way. But since then, John's been quite a good friend and ally of SEC and Farming for a Better Climate. And he's also the Ayrshire chairman for NFU as well. So he's quite he's not scared to put his head above the parapet. John, obviously the last few years have been challenging for everyone, and that's Woodhead as well. The fertilizer prices, weather, all sorts of things have come into play. The fertilizer price story was really the main driver behind going back to do something at Woodhead. Was really, we learned a lot about how to farm with high fertilizer prices. We had 2 years of particularly high prices. They're not back to where they were, probably not going back to where they were. In some ways, the dairy guys were a wee bit insulated by having a pretty strong milk price at the time as well. However, John and many others did make changes to their business. And the question really we were trying to look at, and it's a very complicated question, one that we're not going to nail it down in one small trial, but really is, where is the optimum economically for the optimum spreading rate for fertilizer in a dairy system with slurry? So we wanted to do a bit of work, a bit of kind of plot work, looking at different application rates to see the impact side by side, because that's the challenge we often see, is what works for one farmer doesn't work for the other, or we don't have them. It's not side by side trial, so we can't draw big conclusions from it. I think it's important, before we go into too much detail about what we've done at Woodhead, it's a farmer trial. It's like we've had a wee go at it. It's not going to be a PhD thesis. It's not academically robust, if you like. It's just a bit of a go. But I think there's some interesting conclusions in what we've done. So basically, we've taken one field and looked at four different application rates from what we did prior to the price going down, the price going up, what we did the year before when there was no fertilizer at all, what we did last year when there was a wee bit more put on. So it's it's just looking at some of the options and trying to guide a bit of the conversation as well. And it's been good to have Lorna on board to keep us right with all things soil as well in the background.
I think that's the key, Robert, it's a complex subject. There's lots of variable factors, but the fertiliser price over the last 18 months has really focused the mind of a lot of people and taken into account organic manures, using soil testing more frequently, and actually just, I suppose, making decisions, evidence-based decisions, rather as that's what we did last year, decisions. So I think, it's been, in one way, it's been good now that fertiliser prices are dropping, but I think it has been a good exercise just to concentrate folk on how they're managing their soils and crops.
I think when you see all the developments in soil health and the better understanding of soil as an asset on a farm, you can see why throwing fertiliser about willy-nilly can't be the way to operate anymore. We have to be a bit more scientific about it. It's not just about the money either. It's about emissions and NO2 emissions and a impact on pH and getting the soil biodiversity right as well to make sure that we're, the farm's in as fit and healthy a state as possible. So the other thing I suppose to point out for John is, so he's a first milk producer and he's the kind of guy who's pretty committed to the co-op that First Milk is and what it's all about. So obviously he is now being encouraged to look at some of the regen stuff, some of the new and emerging techniques out there. And he is having a crack at some of them with, some successfully and some less so. And it really just highlights the thing about, we need to try things and see what works in the wet west rather than what works. A lot of the regen stuff comes out of the arable counties in England, and it's about balancing the needs of, or our needs with the outcomes from down there as well.
I'm just thinking about this, and I know you guys will have been banging the drum about this for a long time, but I'm assuming a critical element of this will be the soil analysis and I suppose the slurry analysis on top of that.
Absolutely. It really, everything starts with that soil analysis. And at the moment, there is funding out there through the Pathway to Sustainable Farming, to help with extra analysis. So I think that's one of the keys kind of elements going forward, is that we're actually soil sampling more regularly. As much I see that on my own farm, in the weather patterns that we've had over the last few years, I tend to sample every 1 or 2 years. And depending on whether it's been very wet or very dry, you can see, and also just the yield that take last year, for instance, where we had bumper yields, well, we'd probably, not many people would actually have factored in applying the P&K back on for that extra yield that was taken off. So I think more regular soil testing gives us the opportunity to, almost kind of take a health check in real time of what's going on in the soil. And essentially what's going on in the soil is impacting what's going on above ground. So it's critical. And also we have this valuable resource in our manures. So, why would we not be analysing to see exactly what it is? Because that is the kind of number one way to help save money in your purchase fertiliser, is by actually accounting for what NPK and sulfur you're putting on through your manure. So testing is a huge part of managing your soils appropriately, and you know that's got environmental benefits that we're actually applying according to soil and crop requirements. But you know, it's also the profitability of using that resource that you're producing anyway.
I find the slurry analysis thing really interesting, and I mean, it's not rocket science. If you have a intensive dairy farm with a huge input of bought in feed, there's going to be a lot more poke in that slurry than there is on a suckler system where it's just recycled grass from the same farm. But sometimes when you initially see two slurry analysis next to each other, it's obviously slurry's pretty dilute, and actually the difference in P and K levels don't seem to be massive. But what we've got to keep in mind is that we're actually multiplying that by 2,000 or 3,000 gallons per acre, or you know the slight increase or the slightly more valuable product multiplied by that big multiplier means that the dairy slurry or the intensive dairy slurry is so much more potent than a lower input system. So John probably sits, I would say John is a kind of he's a grass focused semi intensive dairy farmer. He's probably chasing about 8,000 litres. Maybe not even, maybe 7,500 litres. The thing there is his slurry is still a huge resource to him, and there's an awful lot of that. The growth on that farm is driven by slurry, and the fertiliser is really just a top up. So it's important that what we're topping it up with is actually balanced the right way, that it actually keeps us going on the right journey.
I was just thinking, because you mentioned it there, Lorna, like the in terms of the environmental benefits of it, in terms of your greenhouse gas emissions, and Robert, you mentioned it too, a significant proportion of greenhouse gas emissions on the dairy farm will be coming from the N2O, from the however way the soil is managed, so your fertilizer inputs. But also, I suppose there is we don't want excess N getting into watercourses or anything like that. So any kind of leaching is going to have a negative impact. But it's also just a waste. It's such a waste because it's such a valuable asset. So I feel like this kind of understanding the soil analysis and the slurry analysis, and then applying fertilizer off the back of that information is just so beneficial to the whole farm business.
Absolutely. It's got the benefits that you see in your pocket, and it's got the benefits that you don't necessarily see, I suppose, at an individual farm basis, but in terms of a catchment level, if we are seeing cleaner waterways, I mean, I don't think there's any farmer that doesn't want that, you know, for their local area. For every reaction, you know, action, there's a reaction, and in terms of getting the most out of the manures and the nitrogen or, you know, bagged fertilizer you're applying, it's about having productive swards. But it's also about, you know, the conditions of the soil. So that soil structure, any soils that are compacted or waterlogged because of drainage, you know, they're not cycling, that the soil biota is not working. It's not breaking down those manures. It's not releasing the nutrients. So it really is, you know, I think now when we talk about nutrient planning, it should be nutrient planning plus, and it's looking at your soil structure. It's looking at the physical, the biological, the chemical properties of your soil, working up to then, you know, what is your crop? What is its potential? What is its yield? And then, you know, what applications are justified for those situations? So I think, you know, we have a role to play as facts qualified consultants and agronomists, that, you know, we're looking at the whole picture of soil health and not just, you know, crop off takes, if you like. And farmers, have a role, you know, their part in that is analysing, it's providing the data, it's monitoring their soils, you know, just getting out with a spade periodically to see what's going on. Because again, you know, year to year it varies depending on weather conditions and what impact taking three cuts off one field, three up or four applications of slurry, you know, it's a lot of traffic on fields. So I think we need to be better at assessing our soils, assessing our soil structures and our manures more regularly.
Yeah.
And it's something that, you know, none of that is new. Like the triangle, the pyramid, if you like, of priorities. For my grandfather, it went drainage, compaction, P&K, nitrogen, and then maybe sulfur probably wasn't something we had thought of back then, or there was enough of it in a industrial atmosphere that we didn't need to bother. But when we got cheap nitrogen, most of that pyramid for a good number of decades, we forgot about a lot of that and focused entirely on banging on nitrogen. And, you know, guys that did that did what we thought was the right thing at that time, but actually we've come back to this this point where the priorities, and the certainly the best farmers didn't stop doing it, but the priorities are back to where they were, and that drainage compaction story, if we've not got that, we've got nothing at all.
And that can be, there are kind of freely available tools and stuff to help you to better kind of understand your soil structure, the visual evaluation of soil structure, or VES, which SRUC helped to develop years ago. That's still a useful tool, I suppose, for farmers.
Absolutely, and it's really easy to follow, and all it starts with is a spade and going for a wee walk. And it's amazing, you know, just using your senses when you dig a hole. What does it smell like? What does it feel like? You know, what does it look like? And yeah, you don't need to be an expert to identify whether your soil is looking like it's working, you know, nicely, or if, you know, if it's looking like it's struggling. Because one of the key differences, Robert, between what your grandfather was doing and what we're doing nowadays, I guess, is probably the size and the weight of machinery and the frequency of applications. So although we're trying to achieve the same thing, I think we probably have to be a bit more diligent, because we are actually putting a lot more pressure on our soils. But we also probably know an awful lot more and have more tools in the toolbox in terms of, you know, lab analysis and all these different assessment guides to help us through and to make, you know, best decisions based on facts.
The other thing in there to add is the difference in yield that we're demanding as well. You know, what we did in the 40s, 50s, 60s was, you know, it was a fairly light cut of hay and then a wee graze, and that was fine. Stocking rates were really low. Family farms carried, in Ayrshire they carried maybe 30, 40 cows, and that small dairy would support the family plus at least two staff. You know, it's a different world altogether. But when you look at what those farms are now carrying now, there'll be certainly three times the stocking rate. We're looking for a good, you know, at least two cuts of silage off it and a good graze after it. You know, we're actually pushing these soils harder than they've ever been pushed. But if we do it right, we can actually do that and have a healthier soil than we've ever had as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think going forward, there's lots of opportunities, you know, for us to really, I suppose, kind of lead the way in how we manage our soils and what the output from that is in terms of being environmentally better, but also profitability being better, you know, inclusion of clover. There's lots of talk about multi-species swards, and they fit into some systems, not all systems. And that's where we come back to what Robert was saying about every farm is slightly different. Every, you know, soil type is slightly different. So I suppose it's about picking out and trying the things that you think will work on your farm, and then just kind of honing in on that management practice for your own farm. But it's perseverance. There'll be lots of things that work well, lots of things that don't work. But you know, we have to keep trying. But I think now as a farmer, you know, we need to be looking for more in from our consultants and advisors when you're getting fertilizer advice or when you're getting soils as advice. It's got to be a whole package. It's, you know, it's got to be looking at, you know, literally from the ground up. I think the days of send me in 27 ton the same as last year are gone. You know, we now can make it, you know, it doesn't cost any more to get a bespoke fertilizer that is tailored to your soil analysis and your manure analysis. So it just seems crazy that we're over applying nutrients, and also crazy where we're under applying nutrients. And you know, the key to all of that is just soil health, pH. And then essentially, you know, the fertilizers and the manures should just be the kind of icing on top, because the soil's doing the hard yards.
What do you think, Lorna? There's a lot of people, including me at home, last year had a bit of a P&K holiday based on purely economics, yeah. Whether we could afford it or not. Should we be, if you've done that, regardless of where you're at in your soil sampling cycle, should we be back in the field measuring, monitoring, finding out where we are and rectifying that P&K issue as soon as possible, or does wait until next spring?
No, do it now, you know, or it's, depending on when your last kind of manure applications were, but do it sooner rather than later. You know, you can't see it was the wrong thing to do to take a P&K holiday, because actually the pressure that was going to put on you financially to do, you know, what you would have had to do is would have been huge, and combine that with all the extra costs you were facing. But you do have to get in and just at least assess what the impact of that has been. You know, you may go in, take your soil analysis, you know, in the next month or two and see that actually you're still sitting with, you know, moderate plus soils, so then that's absolutely fine. Then you're just working from a point where you're replacing offtakes. But I would suspect last year we probably got away with less fertilizer in a lot of situations last year because we had such a good growing season. But with that good growing season basically also came more offtakes. So I would suspect that you'll see that you probably have got a bit of a deficit in your P&Ks, and especially, you know, those P&K levels in the soil have to be sitting at that moderate status for the nutrients to be available for the crop. You know, they're not instantly available. These things take time to work through the soil. So sampling now, probably rectifying any potash deficiencies in the autumn, and then looking at any phosphate applications that need to go on probably in early spring next year, means that you'll be set up that you're not, you know, you're on a level playing field, if you like, for next year's growing season. Whereas if you wait to next spring, you're already behind the curve. You've probably already seen an impact in reduced yield because of reduced availability of P&K in the soil. And you know that your potash in the soil has such an important part to play in terms of that crop resilience as well. And I think there'll be some people have seen where they've got good potash levels, they've got through this dry spell that we've had this year with grass looking okay, and you can see it driving around the countryside. The farms that are a bit hungry have just suffered a bit more because, you know, the plants haven't had enough potash, so they, you know, they've not had that water flow. And that also goes back, you know, nitrogen needs an adequate potash supply to get the best out of it. So, you know, everything is connected, and if one, I suppose it's like the leaky bucket, isn't it? You know, if there's one element is missing, the impact, you know, flows right through the system in terms of plant resilience, plant response to applied nitrogen. So I would get on sooner rather than later, with just taking a measure of you know, what the impact of your P&K holiday last year was.
It certainly was the year, as you see, you can see the firms who do have low status, but it also shows you that P&K is money in the bank. Yeah. You know, you can, if your soil fertility is good, and who knows what, you know, it looks as if going forward, I mean, that was a particularly turbulent period we just came through or we're going through, but who knows what the next 20 years has in store for us.
That's it.
I would expect us bumps along the way, and as climate change regulations come in and start to bite a bit harder, our options perhaps start to get a bit less, or you know, as I say, who knows what happens. But if we can keep those P&K statuses up and the pH up, it gives us options to take the foot off the pedal without being too detrimental down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. Soil fertility is flexibility. You know, it just gives you a wee bit of leeway if you have to, you know, kind of take a break. The impact isn't as big. You know, certainly if you're in a place where your lime applications are, you know, just down to basic maintenance, even, you know, a ton to the hectare, taking a year off that doesn't hit you so hard the following year to, you know, kind of step up. But I think it's also being aware that when you have a good year or hit a good period with a bit extra cash, just going back to your soil analysis and saying, right, okay, yep, those fields could take a wee lime application, and that would just take the pressure off for, you know, next year or the following year. It's keeping on top of it. And that's where I would be a big advocate of the more often, you know, like probably 2 to 3 years that you're analysing your higher yielding crops, or in terms of cereal crops, probably almost every year, then you just have got a better picture about the trends, about how your soil responds, how quickly your pH levels drop. And you can almost then put a 5-year plan in about how much you need to do each year, and put then factor in the what if scenarios. What if I can't afford to do lime this year and I have to do Dublin a year? Is that actually feasible? Because the worst place to be at the moment, I think, would be on a farm where you're looking at a requirement of hundreds of tons of pH. The cash flow isn't there to do it, but equally you're not getting out the hole because your pH and your soils aren't working, so they're not generating, you know, the yield of forage that helps you get out of the hole. So it's a lot of chicken and egg, but certainly I think, you know, we did it last year where nitrogen was more expensive. We were quite ruthless in saying if your pH was 5.7 or below, no nitrogen, put it into lime. And lots of people have done that and they've seen the benefit from it and they've not been any worse off. So I think, you know, we need to probably be a bit firmer about where the cutoffs are, but also where the opportunities are to future-proof for these spikes, because there's going to be plenty of volatility in all commodities going forward.
And volatility, there's opportunity when there's volatility as well. You know, volatility goes, the nature of being volatile is it goes up and down.
Yeah.
And it means we can take advantage of lower prices and maybe not need to do too much when the prices are too high.
So. Absolutely. And especially in the west coast of Scotland, you know, we can grow forage where, you know, soil conditions and, you know, fertility is right. We can grow forage. And that is also a wee bit of, I suppose, insulation to volatility, that if you can grow grass, it's the cheapest feed that we can produce. And it's not coming in a wagon. So, you know, forage is our biggest opportunity, and just to be able to make the most of that, it's making sure our soil and our nutrient planning is right.
Yeah, and I like what was said there as well about kind of building in that resilience, and I think you did mention it, Robert, but there is that resilience to the actual impacts of climate change as well, that I think everyone will have seen over the last few years. Part of the kind of bumper crop or a big part of probably the bumper crop that we mentioned last year was down to the weather and just a kind of a perfect season. And this year then, you know, there is a, we don't know how it's going to go yet, but it's certainly, I would say most people would probably say that it has been drier over the summer months and in the previous few years. And if that is to continue or to accelerate, you know, you're just building in that buffer and building in resilience to your soil.
It just shows you though how, you know, we've have very short memories, because at the moment we've just had the hottest, driest June. I'm not sure about driest, but certainly the hottest June on record. And July's been a bit of a washout in our part of the world so far. The Woodhead trial that we've done, or a work we've done, we had to wait, or John chose to wait before we applied fertilizer until there was at least rain in the forecast between first and second cut. So the second cut fertilizer was actually only on for just over 3 weeks. So it was a relatively small amount went on, and certainly the crop would be growing to use all that up. But we went from having a too dry to spread fertilizer situation to snatch and second cut, and he actually got it very good, but he had to be pretty brave to do it. So it's interesting how even within the year, and that's not, I don't think that's a resilience to climate change, it's a resilience to weather, because we've always had fluctuations like that in weather, but certainly as the, if the climate change predictions are correct, we're going to have more extremes, and that includes extreme hot, extreme dry, extreme wet. The interesting one at the moment, this is a wee bit of a tangent, but the El Nino story is fairly emerging at the moment, with which is obviously, again, it's not a climate change story, it's a climate cycle story. But with a changing climate plus a strong El Nino, I think there's quite a lot of predictions out there that the next year or so is going to be pretty extreme out there, and there's going to be some real weather stories happening. So that, just that resilience to everything, you know, fill in the pit, making sure that we've got options to make what, you know, decisions, whatever's thrown at us. If we've got a pit of silage somewhere, if it's too dry and all the grass disappears, we've got something to feed. If it's too wet and we've got to house, we can feed. You know, the priority now, I think, above all else for dairy farmers, for most farmers, is to conserve as much winter forage as possible, and it, as Lorna says, it's money in the bank.
Yeah, and if you've got that flexibility with your soil fertility, it also gives you options to look at the different ways that you achieve that forage yield, whether it is looking at shorter rotation grasses, which are going to yield, you know, greater amounts of in the shoulders of the season, so you're kind of extending your growing season, if you like, or your opportunity, because the last, 4 years, we've hit a dry spell every year. It's just been slightly different as to when that dry spell is, or whether it is, you know, even like a summer forage crop, because we're seeing that June and July is actually when we hit a bit of a kind of sticky period, or it's looking at more, I mean, it seems a bit crazy because it rained in Stranraer from the 1st of September until about the 15th of April. And then in a matter of 3 weeks, we thought we were in a desert. But, you know, just looking at the species of grass or herbs or clovers that we're sowing, which are, you know, just a bit more tolerant to, you know, dry weather or wet weather. So I think the days of looking at our farms as just being grass farms are past. We now, you know, need to look at them in terms of what are the soil types, what are the strengths and weaknesses of certain parts of the farm, how do we manage them differently, how do we manage them at different times, and what are the species or the mixtures of grass or forage that are suited to those areas. So it almost, you know, it's thinking of your grassland farm as more like an arable, in an arable rotation, rather as just the same grass mixture in every single field everywhere. You know, we've got to be a bit more tuned in to soil types and the strengths and weaknesses and how that can benefit us, you know, during dry spells or wet spells.
And also challenge seed salesmen and suppliers as well. You know, if you're looking to do something a bit different and doing a multi-species herbal lay type job, first of all, sit down and think what you need. So is it a cutting or is it a grazing story? Is it for cattle? Is it for sheep? Where are you in the world? How much rainfall do you get? How, you know, what are we actually trying to achieve? Because I think what we are seeing, I'm sure it'll be the same down with you, Lorna, is there's a lot of off-the-shelf seed mixes that are going in, and actually they don't fit the needs of a farm. You know, there's a lot of chicory and plantain getting sown in silage fields, and unless we change the nature of change the actual makeup of the chicory and plantain plant, it's not going to last. It's not going to be there, and it's not going to achieve you that much in a silage mix. However, if we put in multiple species of, you know, high quality grass plus red and white clover, we have a multi-species sward, we have a deeper rooting sward, we get the benefits of it, but also get something that works for us. So I think that, similar to the fertilizer story, fully challenge people, and actually the people you're challenging want that challenge as well. If you've got a good agronomist seed salesman, they want to have a conversation with you at the kitchen table about what you're trying to achieve, rather than just selling you a pallet of stuff that's not really fit for purpose and going to be back to weeds in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, it's thinking in advance, you know, why you're doing it, what you're trying to achieve. And there's no doubt that multi-species swards have their place, but you have to think about where that place is. And for me, I see it on dairy farms, it's probably in the grazing rotation for young stock, because it you know, it grows high quality feed, higher mineral content in the crop, suits being managed, but has to be managed rotationally, so you can tighten up the area that you're using for young stock. You can probably knock out that wee pickle cake that they've been getting, and with the clover's inclusion in it, you're not needing any nitrogen. So that's, you know, chicory and plantain aren't suited to a competitive grass sward for silage, because it's just too competitive. They like to be grazed, rested. So that's where I would see it in a dairy situation, that it, you know, it's better suited to young stock grazing, and then, you know, and winter time they're very sensitive to overgrazing. So again, you're getting your young stock into the house through the winter, so it's getting that rest, but it's also probably giving you an opportunity for a slightly earlier turnout. But it's just, I suppose, taking a wee while to step back and think about what you're doing or what you want to achieve, and then work backwards. Whereas I think quite often you just order the seed and then go, oh, it's not actually really doing what I needed it to do, but that's because it's not, you know, the right mixture composition for what you're actually needing.
It's also quite interesting when you look at, if you improve soil fertility for the same reseed, if P and K levels are good, pH is good, and we don't spray out the clover, you can have a vastly different seed mix with exactly this, or a vastly different sward with exactly the same seed mix. You know, the fundamental stuff, I suppose we're beating the drum again, but the fundamental stuff pre-reseed, pre-anything, you know, getting that soil in as good a health as possible.
That's it. We're limited for options in terms of controlling weeds, especially with clover. I think there's possibly some new products coming onto the market, but we have to, I think, go back to, you know, probably the your kind of grandfather's methods of using small mouths to graze a new lay, you know, just to nip the top off, encourage it to tiller so it's competing with the weeds, and then look at using sheep to control the weeds, or looking at topping weeds, but trying a few things before we get to the point where we go, this has to be sprayed, and it's going to have to be sprayed with something that takes out the clover. You know, I think we need to be persevere a bit more before we come to the conclusion that it has to be sprayed, and we accept that the clover is going to be taken out, because there are options, and it comes back to the better the conditions that grass plant goes into, the more competitive it will be, and the more likely it is to outcompete any weeds that are coming.
The fertilizer being used at Woodhead, like, there's different kind of fertilizer products, you know, like slow release fertilizer and these kind of things. Have you looked at any of that in the trial, or has it just been kind of maintaining what John has been always done?
Yeah, so we used the product that was balanced for John's needs after GPS soil sampling it. Yeah. And the thing, the slow release story wouldn't really suit here. So when we're trying to ensile grass, certainly we want the nitrogen out it.
Mm.
So what basically it's conventional fertilizer, which is the most of his growth is coming from slurry. The bag tops it up, and basically every 6 weeks he'll be cutting and pitting. So it's a fairly conventional story.
Okay. And actually, John is supplying the majority of his P and K through his slurry. There was some fields that were needing a wee top up with, I think, phosphate mostly, but really, you know, in terms of things like products like your polysulfate, you know, your potash, sulfur, calcium products that are kind of slow release, they're not really fitting in this system because of what he's supplying with his slurry.
Yeah.
And it's certainly, he's in a low phosphate. John's actually not far from me, and we're all in a low phosphate area. A lot of southwest Scotland's low phosphate, but our valley's pretty low phosphate, so it's something we're all having to work on. Mm. So it's not a surprise to see that he's slightly low. He's not, you know, through the Focus Farm project, at that stage, he was spreading a lot of fertilizer actually, and we dropped P and K out, but the P has been eroded a wee bit, so it's a matter of dribbling it back into the system to get it back up. And probably knowing that means we kind of got it wrong. We took a wee bit, or he took it out for too long, or we should have been topping it up. But it's not a yield limiting issue. It's a top up.
And it also just highlights the importance of analysing the slurry so that you know what you're putting on. But one thing that is very tricky with grass is actually getting an accurate yield. So actually that under application has probably just been a symptom of underestimating what his yield offtakes have been. Yes. And now it's something you're aware of, you know, like, Robert says, it's a case of kind of, you know, just dripping it back into the system either on an annual or a biannual, you know, basis. So
it's interesting to see though that he's got, you know, silage is sore on potash. So silage, you always, you know, your traditional silage fertilizer would have a high potash level because there's always a big offtake, and his slurry's totally handling the potash element, but the phosphate's low. So it's an interesting balance. You would normally expect to see the phosphate a wee bit higher as well, but it really just goes to show us there is no, I mean, we still have a number of older clients who talk about grazing fertilizer and silage fertilizer, and they'll just order silage fertilizer. But you know, those days are, there's not many of them left, and those days are certainly are numbered. We're better than that now.
And so just to finish up then, what are the expected outputs from this, or when are you expecting to have outputs, and when can we all kind of see it?
Yeah, so we've got the outputs are a few podcasts, a few videos, and a wee write-up as well. So the outputs basically are based on yields from a cuts of silage, so it's not going to be a hugely groundbreaking. I hope it's something that's useful to kind of focus people's minds. And actually what I think the output for me is, the ultimate output, is that people actually go and do something like this themselves, is actually take a wee field at home. We are not, I think this is interesting, and hopefully we'll have some interesting results for people. We're not reinventing the wheel. We're actually trying to encourage people to take a look at their own situation and find out what their optimum is too. Because as we've said right through this, all farms are different, all farmers are different, all systems are different. So actually taking that wee step back, and there's no sacrifice here. What we've done at Woodhead is we've applied slightly more onto one area and slightly less onto the other area. And on average, the application will be the same, and I expect the yield across the field will be pretty similar. You know, the total yield out the field will not be massively different. So we're not sacrificing I feel like I'm trying to justify this to John. We're very grateful for John to let us be there. But it's not as if he's going to have half a pit of silage because we're tweaking things. My worry is that rather than tweaking it in one field, people actually just go and make whole scale changes across their whole system based on no information. Have a go, just don't spread any fertilizer and see what happens. And we saw that last year, and to an extent most people got away with it, but they only just got away with it. So we're trying to encourage people to have a more educated approach to what they're doing on their own farms.
I assume as well that you know, the outcome of this will guide what John does next year in that field. Do you know what I mean? So it's like that's really the kind of the idea of it all, isn't it? That what happens next year will hopefully boost the yield from that field if it can, or kind of find that optimum exactly. point. So
and we're also quite keen to run this next year as well, because I think the soil is we work in annual cycles. You know, farmers work in annual cycles, but soils don't. You know, there's the impact of what we're doing here. If we do it for 2 years, if we do it for more, we can see what the longer term impact is, and see where we go. So yes, we're quite happy to run this through 2024 as well, and see what's doing. I don't know if I've actually told John that, but I'm assuming he's keen.
Yeah, I hope that John, you know, it just, I suppose, gets him into a mindset where he's a bit more proactive. You know, he's using data to kind of influence his decisions, but with that proactive approach, you know, every year in the farming climate is different, so there has to be a reactive element, but that, you know, there's a combination of two rather as just purely being reactive, which I think, you know, happens with a lot of farmers. So, you know, we speak about that, just giving him the flexibility to respond to the year as it evolves. But he's doing that with, you know, experience and some science behind him to give him the confidence to make those decisions.
That's great. Well, thanks very much, Robert and Lorna, for coming on.
Thanks, Seamus.
Yeah, thank you.
For more information, please visit the Farming for Better Climate website, and you can find other Farming for Better Climate podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.